White Rocket Entertainment.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The second pod is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello, and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment, along with people like you via Patreon.com. Well, I just got back from Dragon Con 2017, and I recorded several panels there. Really cool stuff on a lot of topics. But here's one I really wanted to get done and get out to you as soon as possible. That is my interview moderating job I did with Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell. Of course, Larry and Jerry are two of the absolute top luminaries in the field of science fiction, having created such amazing works over the years as Lucifer's Hammer, A Mote in God's Eye, Oath of Fealty, Legacy of Heorot, and so many more. And I was very privileged to be asked by Dragon Con and the Sci-Fi Lit Track to be the moderator for their panel in front of a big ballroom full of attendees who are all very excited to be there and to hear them speak. If you enjoy this show, please consider helping out joining the White Rocket Entertainment family by going to patreon.com, patreon.com, and becoming a member. For as little as $1 a month, you can help us continue to produce shows like the one you are about to hear, and we really appreciate it. And as always, we thank Nicholas Cottrell, David Medinas, Mark Squire, Dave Powell, Jared Albrick, Rich Reimer, Michael Kirshner, Bill Matthews, Joey Miller, Matthew Wagstaff, Chris Thrash, Wes Atkinson, J.W. Rice, Phil Amthor, Randall Walker, Richard Stevens, and War Damn Wade, as well as our anonymous one-time contributors. All of you folks are enormously appreciated for what you do to help us stay on the air. So, without further ado, here is me, along with Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell, at Dragon Con 2017.
All right, can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
It's working. Microphones at work at Dragon Con. Wow. Dragon Con 2017. Hello. A couple of years ago, we brought you Larry Niven, and that wasn't enough. We brought back his partner in crime, Jerry Purnell, too. So, I don't think they need much introduction, but I'll throw out a little bit. I know that they are both two of the great science fiction writers of America, of all time, really. And they can, each one of you can kind of tell me in a minute what you consider to be sort of your the works you would throw out there. I know that, you know, Larry's probably best known for Ringworld, which is the 1970 novel about the ring around the star and the puppeteers and the humans and the Kazinti that go out there. And Jerry's written Janissaries, among other great works. And also, they've collaborated together on New York Times bestsellers that have been fantastic, humongous successes. So, well, you know, and it's funny you say only, because really, I mean, that's something we're going to try to get into a little bit as we go along here, is that it could have been more. So let's just kick it right off then. What, let's talk about your collaborations first. I want to talk about a little bit of each one of you a little bit together, but and then I'm going to get questions from the audience halfway through. But when it comes to you guys working together, let's go all the way back to the beginning. And Larry, let me ask you first, Larry. How did you guys end up working together, and what was the attraction?
The question you're supposed to ask,
okay,
is, how do you two work together?
How do you stand it?
You're supposed to ask, how do we work together?
Well, I'm just building up to that, but sure, yes, okay, that's fine. How do you work together?
Two-sided.
Superbly.
Superbly.
That's right. No doubt about it. No.
We get that question often enough, we have a standard answer.
Gotcha. So how did it first happen?
Jerry tracked me down. We had known each other at LASFAS, the Los Angeles Science Benefit Society, the oldest science fiction club still operating. And one Sunday afternoon after a voucher, Jerry suggested we write together. And I'd already done a collaboration with David Gerald and enjoyed it very much. So what the hell?
Yeah, that was the Flying Sorcerers, I believe.
Yeah, Flying Sorcerers with David Gerald, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And A Moaning God's Eye with Jerry.
Flying Sorcerers was... David Gerald was actually... we thought he was going to be the third author in another book we did, but he said he would do it, but after a year it became pretty obvious he wasn't. He had too many other commitments, so that's how Steve Barnes got in that afterwards, which turned out to be a very good thing. Steve's very terrific. I got out of the aerospace business because I was the science project manager for Apollo 18. You will point out that there was no Apollo 18.
There was no Apollo 18.
Yes. I decided that I would accept Pepperdine College's offer of a professorship. So I went over there, and after about 3 years of this edit, there was easier ways to starve to death than being a professor. And after some other work, I eventually turned to fiction, and it was obvious that the first thing to do is you got to get somebody to know who the hell you are. So I looked among the writers of science fiction who I thought wrote stories that I could add something to, because it would just be pointless if I couldn't. And Paul Anderson and Larry Niven both came to mind. Paul lived in the Bay Area. Larry lived about a mile and a half from my house. So I tracked him down and I made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
So what you're saying is, you looked at Larry and you said, A, he's nearby, and B, he needs something added to his work.
No, you've got the wrong impression. A, he's good enough that I think that would be worthwhile collaborating.
There you go. There we go. All right. Very good.
And since he's about the best short story writer in this business, that's fairly obvious. No, I made him an offer he couldn't refuse. I said, he gets final say on any disagreements we have. We've always had that agreement. It's not always him anymore, but somebody's got to be in charge. As far as I know, neither one of us has ever used that prerogative, but there needs to be some. And I would do all the work of coordinating so that it didn't look like two people had written the book, so that it smoothed out to look like...
Absolutely.
And remember, this is in the days of typewriting. In those days, if you wanted to improve an already professionally typed work, you had to start tearing up printed pages, and now either you've got to retype that, which God knows I hate, and I suspect every writer does, or something's got to happen. So scribbling on that piece of paper means that you're committed to writing a whole page at least, and maybe more. And if it comes out in more, you got to partial pages, and you know, so I'd be sent off. And so I said, I'll do all that work, and I'll take care of the publicity, and you stick with me, and we'll get rich and famous.
There we are.
To which Larry replied, I'm already rich. So I quickly amended that to say, fine, I'll get rich, we'll both get famous.
In any case, it worked.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, you talk about the technology, I was going to go there, that it's got to be fascinating to see how over the years you guys have really run the gamut of working on typewriters all the way up to computers. I know you were very, very big in the computer field, so you were probably, because of your impatience with dealing with typewritten papers, you must have been like, computers, let's go, hurry up, get better.
Jerry formed the computer.
I wrote the first novel ever written on the computer.
Awesome, amazing.
Bob Forward wrote something, but his was about 2 years later than mine, and his was not written on a personal home computer. It was written on a what the hell was he with? Hughes.
It was
written on an 1101 in a big mainframe. And
writing in punch cards.
Yeah, basically. So David Gerald had a kind of a hybrid. He had a way of writing so that it made an electronic company, but then you had to print it out. And it printed on a Selectric typewriter. Mm. That was a very short period of time. The magnetic tape recording stuff for that. But I wrote my first book on a computer. And Larry looked at what I had and he said, I want that.
Tony Peach was the other man. Jerry Fornell and Tony Peach put together the first computer that writes like a writer that I know of. And when they got it perfected, I asked Tony to put together two of them for me. One for my wife and also for spares. In those days, you needed spares.
Which book was it, Jerry, by the way, that was the first one?
You know, I'd have to look it up. I don't remember. I think it may have been Spaceship for the King.
I do remember. Halfway through the Ringworld Engineers, I started writing on a computer.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You may be able to tell, you may not.
Football was mostly done on a computer. Molten Gods, I was totally on Selectric typewriters. Inferno, did we get in the computer business with Inferno?
Let's see, there was Molten Gods, I, then...
We started on Oath of Fealty, yeah.
Hmm.
And halfway through Oath of Fealty, I remembered that in college, I had daydreamed about wandering through hell without a guy. Or without a guy you could call on angels. And I've been hiking with Jerry, or actually I've been drinking with Jerry. and I knew he was intensely interested in theology. He had all the background I needed. So I made him write Inferno with me. Sequel to Dante's Inferno. Can you imagine how much nerve that took?
It seems to have worked at one of the bestsellers. So.
And they teach you.
Actually, Inferno was enormously successful. It caused them to reissue the Chiardi translation of Dante and two or three other things, and got responsible for an academic wave of interest in Dante for a while, which was kind of gratifying because I didn't think we were going to make much money on Inferno. Like him, I thought that's a pretty daring thing to do, that we're going to write something about.
Imagine all the criticism you're inviting.
Yes.
I like the idea that you wrote part of this super futuristic Ring World Engineers on a typewriter, but you wrote a book like Inferno on a computer. That, to me, that's like, that's pretty funny, right? I just thought of it. You know, you'd think you'd write Inferno on like parchment with blood or something almost. I don't know, but
that's
pretty
sure we wrote Inferno entirely on a typewriter.
That's really interesting.
We wrote Inferno on typewriter.
Oh, okay. All right.
But we had started Oath of Fealty on typewriters, and after we finished Inferno, we went back to Oath, and by then we were beginning to work with computers. So Oath of Fealty may have been the first one. Footfall was on computers, but it was still at a time when the way you did it is you wrote the book, you wrote a chapter, you printed it out on a Diablo printer that looked like a Selectric typewriter.
You printed Inferno on a Diablo, I love it.
And it printed back and forth, and it took yes. all night to print a book. And then you did the editing on the paper, and then you put the, but all you had to type in now was the changes. You didn't have to retype all of the text that wasn't changed. Larry was pleasantly surprised to discover that it only took him a couple of hours to put like a month's worth of editing changes in.
Yeah, editing on a computer was so easy that if you read it over, if you read the manuscript over, you would be editing as you go, aimlessly. The computer erases your mistakes faster than you can make them. I was delighted.
Any of you remember Selectric typewriters? When they invented that correcting tape in it, that was like a miracle.
Yeah, I would say younger people now don't really understand the idea that when you used to hit the button, that it instantly printed on the paper and there was no going back, really, you know. So, yeah, it's made quite a difference.
Yeah, our tools were scissors and Scotch tape and whiteout.
Yeah, and you learn vintage years of whiteout. Some years and whiteout was better than other years. You stocked up on the good years.
The vintage. Well, let me ask you about Oath of Fealty. Can you mention that? I'm getting the sense, and tell me if I'm wrong, I'm getting the sense that you guys have been working on it for a while, maybe on and off. Is that right? Or how did that come about?
Oath of Fealty went like this. We had finished Emoting God's Eye, and we're ready for a new project. And Jerry's got this stack of stuff, big stack of papers, an extensive list of near future predictions, including the, you use a cure at the coffee machine, you're familiar with those? We had that happening in Oath of Fealty. Jerry had it in his stack of predictions. We went through the predictions and carved out a story. No, we didn't. We kept going through that list until I showed up at your house one day, and you said, shall we go through these other predictions? And I said, no, it's time to write a book.
That's probably true. Yeah, that
it happened.
I'd been deputy mayor of Los Angeles at one point, so I had some idea about city government. If you haven't read Oath of Fealty, it still holds up, kind of, but it's before the internet, and it's before high-speed communication between computers. There's a scene in it in which you obey a court order. The people that, there's a big one-building city in it, basically.
Two miles by a fifth of a mile high, with air holes in the top. lighting holes that I put in.
Larry's phrase, which is beautiful, I've never come up with it, said it looked from the air like the box the Great Pyramid had come in. Because there were internal balconies and so forth. And anyway, I have a scene in there in which, in order to obey a court order, they're printing out some city records at 2,400 baud. Which gives you some idea of it was done well before computers got all that big. And it was only, it was maybe only fourth or fifth book ever written on a computer at that time, even then. Anyway, if In Enough is a bestseller, which I had intended it to be when I plowed out this.
Yeah,
crazy.
It's always to be bestsellers.
Yeah. we don't, it's kind of pointless for Larry and me to write, try to just write a fun story. Once in a while we can, but in general, between the two of us, we're likely to produce a bestseller. So why not do it?
Sure. Well, let's talk about that then. Maybe the one you're most famous for in the general public, because it's not so much a more of a specialized science fiction book, but more like a disaster book, is Lucifer's Hammer. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I hear, appreciate that book. There's got to be an interesting story about how that all came together. I may have asked Larry about it a little bit before, but let's get you both of your thoughts on kind of how that happened.
I probably told that story when you interviewed me.
Yeah.
Let's get Jerry's version.
Okay.
Well, I was sitting in my office. We hadn't published Lucifer's Hammer, so I hadn't rebuilt my house yet. So I was in the old downstairs office in my house, where I am now because I can't go up and down the stairs to the new office, but that's something else again. And the phone rang, and it's Bob Gleason, who had been the editor at Pocket Books, who had bought Moton God's Eye. And he said, "You guys ought to write a story about, there needs to be a good alien invasion story." And I talked to him for a while about it, and okay, come up with something. So I told Larry, and his first remark was, "I hope you told him it's already been done." And I said, "Yes, of course it's already been done, but as Larry likes to observe, we'd have had the Martians
in zoos by the end of the day if they'd invaded in Britain.
Yeah, they had them in zoos by tea time. So this was going to be a real alien invasion story. So we wrote up the outline, and as part of the invasion, the aliens, of course, soften up the earth by hitting it with a great big rock. Now, if that sounds like the plot for another book that we wrote, it probably is, but Gleason basically telegraphed, "Forget aliens, concentrate on that rock." And so
I changed the asteroid into a comet so you could see it coming. I like the visuals.
And it was a lot more fun. There was a lot less known about comets in those days. I was president of Science Fiction Writers of America in the early 70s. And one of the things I managed to do was get JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Caltech's wizards, to let SFWA members have press passes to the planetary encounters. Now, in those days, planetary encounters like the first pioneers and the first mariners were a big deal. I mean, there was a hall at JPL about the size of this room, and it was filled with press, TV, cameras, and everything. And you get to talk to all the scientists. So we were out at JPL a lot, and we learned a lot about everything that anybody knew about comets. We knew it by then because we talked to the people who were discovering it. And that made for Hammer to be very realistic on that score. So we got that right. And then we had to come up with the aftermath and so forth. Actually, we planned a longer book than it was, but which if you can believe it. I say it that way because after we finished it, the editors loved it, but they said, it's too long. What do you mean it's too long? Well, paperbacks won't sell at more than $3.95, and it'll cost that much to manufacture it. It's so thick. Could we cut it into two volumes? Well, it wasn't written to be cut into two volumes. We couldn't do it. But no company had ever made a profit from a paperback that sold more than $3.95 at the time it came out. So they gulped hard and put it out at $5.95, and of course it got to the number two on the bestseller list and just stayed there forever. So it worked. But that was the first book that anybody made a profit on it at $6.
This is coming out of an era when most science fiction paperbacks are about 160 pages or so, right? And you got
50,000 words used to be a novel. That's what the novel category is to this day, is 50,000 words or more. But in fact, nobody writes 50,000 word novels nowadays. No. But they didn't. Yeah, science fiction. Remember, science fiction only got a certain amount of rack space.
Right.
Well, if you put a thick book in there, you don't get as many books in that rack space. Fortunately, we insisted on calling Hammer science fiction. And we actually got drugstores and places like that. In those days, there were more paperbacks sold in drugstores than in bookstores. And we actually got the truck drivers to insist on more rack space for science fiction because Lucifer's Hammer was selling so damn well. It never made number one. Because while it sat there at number two on the bestseller list, that damn thorn nerd, Susan.
Damn thorn nerd, sorry.
Had the nerve to write the best damn historical novel I ever read. Oh, well.
That's amazing. So it was the first to be that big and have to cost that much. Yeah. And we were talking the last panel that books, you know, science fiction books today are all roughly that size. Okay. It's hard to find one smaller.
Well, but you must understand, Hammer got the biggest advance that had ever been paid for a science fiction novel.
Wow.
We got essentially a quarter of $1 million,
$236,500.
Yeah. Who knows? He made it to combinations with bicycle. we got that, and the biggest advance that had ever been paid in science fiction up until that time was Arthur C. Clarke. Had got $100,000 on a three-book deal. So, yeah, I mean, it was a huge thing. And after it started selling, other big thick books like that started coming out. And science fiction got bigger advances. And meanwhile, fans kept coming up to us and saying, how dare you take all of that money and that nice and none left for us? Which got me irritated enough that I became rather impolite in my answers. I used to say, You don't understand. It earned out. We're making money for the publisher who can buy it so he can buy your miserable.
I asked Joe Haldeman a couple of years ago, because he's one of the few that still writes the smaller books, you know. And I said, but do you get pressure from the publisher to write these big, thick books now? He goes, oh, I get the pressure, but, you know, I don't. So it's there definitely is moved in that direction.
The publisher will always give a writer his head if he has faith in him. Mm-hmm. You don't have to listen to what he actually wants or thinks he wants.
Yeah, we've got to the point where we can sell any length we feel like, if we want to sell it at all, because we could also just have our agent publish it on without a publisher at all. Most of our books, we wrote them, a lot of the big ones like Hammer, were written before there was any such thing as electronic rights. So we own them because they weren't in the contract and we didn't own them. So we own them. Now, they are published nowadays by our agent, which we didn't have to have happen. We could have just published them ourselves, and God knows I've got the technical support to be able to publish anything, number one.
But an agent is a wonderful invention.
Yeah.
Leaves you free to write.
Yeah. Eleanor, Lurton Glassingame sold the books in the first place. And it just and Eleanor is the partner he brought in after he got Parkinson's. And she took care of him and actually kept his office alive and everything. It just seemed right to let them continue to get their agency fee. I mean, that's what they do. She publishes them and she gets the agency fee for doing it now. That seems to work out very well. We get all the advantages of an agent and a publisher. And instead of us getting a 10% royalty, we get 70% minus 15. So that works.
We're actually making better royalties with these books than H.G. Wells did.
Oh, yeah.
He used to get 25%. I had to sell my first novel for 4% royalty.
Yeah. It was bad in the old days. And of course, nowadays people have got it easy. As I was telling the kids in another panel, the good news is anybody can be a writer. Anybody can publish. The bad news is that anybody can publish. And getting somebody to pick out you from the rest of the crowd is a little harder now.
That's right. Let me ask you about, we kind of skipped past The Mote in God's Eye, and I want to get, and we'll get the audience to start asking questions in a couple of minutes, but I have to get that one in there. And in fact, we haven't talked about Mote in God's Eye or Footfall. You alluded to Footfall and how you kind of had come up for the premise for Footfall already with Lucifer's
Hand. We had half an outline for the book.
I remember when I read it the first time thinking, you know, this seems kind of familiar somehow. So how did it... So you went ahead and did the book that focused just on the rock hitting and the aftermath, but you still wanted to do the aliens, right? So how did you come back around and bring the aliens in for another go?
Bob Gleason, who told us to write Lucifer's Hammer, asked when he was going to get the aliens.
Yeah.
He was in the back of my car at the time, and I thought it over, and I thought maybe 5 years, and I heard this god-awful gasp, and Bob saying... I just saw my whole life and it took us about 5 years.
You'd be surprised at how motivating it is to have the editor-in-chief of a publishing house trying to bully you into getting a book done. Well, I can offer you that. It turns out to be an exhilarating, and of course, Footfall did hit number one on the bestseller list. So, yeah.
So, how did you decide that you had another book in you using a similar idea? You said, all right, well, if we do the aliens, then
no, it wrote itself. in the sense that we already had the moon of Saturn being used as the impact point for football already in outline. Switching to a comet allowed us to make it somewhat different, so we weren't repeating ourselves. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the secret is you watch the impact from orbit in football. That's India going under.
And the football came about because why do the Indians want to invade? Interstellar commerce is going to, particularly if you, we assume no faster than light. Einstein's right that there's another limit to. Well, in that case, what the hell are they coming here for? Well, the only possible reason they'd be coming is because they want to live here. Well, that means they don't want to mess up the Earth to the point it's unlivable, but it would be sort of nice to soften things up. To me, it began to write itself that way. If you assume that we're talking about Orion-type technology, and they got here, took them, I don't know, 50, 70 years to get here from Alpha Centauri, and they're coming here because they want to take it. They need the land. They want to live here. They don't want to live in orbit. They want to live on the Earth. That's an entirely different book from Invasion from Mars, where they were just coming here from pure meanness, as far as I can tell. We've never had the problem of why would the Martians want to invade? Because they're close enough that, well, it's easy to do, so why not?
Why not?
But to get here from another star, especially if there's no faster than light, which as far as I know, it's still faster than light is fantasy.
Yeah.
Then there has to be a reason for it, and that makes a much different story from here come the nasty old aliens, they're invading.
We worked out the aliens in enough detail that we could turn it into a detective story.
Yeah.
That took some doing.
Well, what about the human characters in these books? Because in all of your really big stories, you know, you've got the aliens, you've got the comet or whatever, but you've also got the humans that are kind of on the receiving end of everything. How do you develop the characters that are going to be our way of seeing how everything plays out? I mean, going in, you're like, I have a guy that's this, or a woman that's like this. I mean, you have a plan, they just kind of develop organically as you're collaborating.
Oh, Lucifer's Hammer, I'm remembering Harry the Mailman. Harry is off to the side when the hammer is striking the earth. We did a lot of deaths due to the comet, but Harry is just trying to get through weird storms.
I think he just said, I basically figure out that people have to be in the storm. Okay. In Lucifer's Hammer, the basically the protagonist and the senator and some of the those are all mine in the sense that we need these people. I don't say I develop the characters because Larry does a lot of that too, but I pretty well put in the ones we have to have: the engineer, the deputy mayor, the guy who's in charge of the nuclear power plant, that sort of stuff. Then there's the villains, and we've got to work them in. And the fact that both Larry and I have been scoutmasters made some of that part of the book easy. And it works. In general, if a character runs around in circles flapping his arms, or he's extremely competent, but he's also a horse's ass, that's going to be Nimitz.
Strengths,
He's going to be sort of rigid and nearly emotionless, and the captain of the ship, and he's got a job to do, and he's going to do it. That's pretty well going to be fun. But don't kid yourself that you know that, because it won't always be true. I will make you the same bat, all of you, that I make anybody. You can't read Moton God's eye and tell who wrote which scene or which wrote which characters. You will not know. Mr. Heinlein couldn't even figure out who had written what scene. He congratulated me on several of Larry's scenes and Larry on a couple of mine. We tried very hard to make sure that those books looked like they were written by one person. Not a collaboration of two people which got these characters.
In fact, it was one of our rules. When we were writing A Moaning God's Eye, Jerry said, we're going to get to the end and some of our styles won't match, so one of us is going to write the book, rewrite the book from the beginning to smooth out all the jarring inconsistencies in style. And he said, I'll do that. And I was like,
yeah, that was the offer that he couldn't refuse. Moat, if you read Moat, it reads pretty fast, doesn't it? I mean, there don't seem to be any wasted words. Well, I'll tell you the secret on that one. We had Mr. Heinlein read the manuscript. I can tell you the story now because one of the conditions of his doing it was that we couldn't tell anybody until after he was dead. As you said, I have too many friends who will wonder why I don't do this for them. One of the things he said was, this book could be much better if it was cut by 10%. Now remember, this is in typewriter days. I got to cut 10% out of here. All right. That's...
And he didn't tell you which 10%. Just no, some 10%.
10%. And
fewer notes.
Those of you who have read Mr. Heinlein's last novels will understand he should have done that. But I wasn't about to tell him that. Anyway, remember, this is barely in computer time. And it's all typewriters and pages. Okay, there's 10 words to a line and 25 lines to a page. So that's 250 words to a page, approximately. That means I've got to get 25 words off of each page. So I literally got a sheet of paper. Page one, I eliminated 12 words. I've got to get 37 out of the next page. So on this page, I managed to get 45 words out so I can be a little more lenient on this. Literally, I went through that book page by page and cutting every damn superfluous word, sentence, anything that didn't, because I would got to get rid of the words. Well, the result is that a lot of that book reads like lightning now. It really, it is all action. And that's kind of interesting because in the last half of the book, not much happens. But you don't notice that because not much happens awful fast.
Let me quickly say, if you guys have questions for him, come to the microphone right here and line up, and we'll get some questions from you guys. I'm sure you have some better ones than me, so we'll go ahead and let you guys be asking. You want to go ahead, the first one, while we maximize our time. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Stephanie.
We are collecting for the Special Olympics. That is DragonCon's charity this year. They have agreed to match up to $100,000, if I understand.
Yes.
We've been passing around basically a collection plate, and I need that to be brought back to the front.
The last person who gets it cannot keep it.
Yes, please. So whoever has it, please bring it to me.
It's for Special Olympics, not special geeks.
Yes, special for Special Olympics. Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Deb. All right. Let's get our first question from the gentleman.
Jerry, I want to ask you about one of my favorite authors when I was a kid, and that was H. Beam Piper. And I know that H. Beam Piper of Little Fuzzy, and I know that you know, he gave you permission to write in his universe. And I just want to know, how did he influence you, or how did you influence him?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get
H. Beam Piper. He said, "How did H. Beam Piper influence you, or did you influence him?"
Oh well, I met Beam at Chicago Worldcon in, I guess, 1962. I had nothing to do with science fiction up until about the same day. In 1961, I went to the Seattle Worldcon, and I met Mr. Heinlein and Paul Anderson, both of whom became pretty good friends for the rest of my life. And we corresponded a lot, and I stayed at Paul's house when I'd go to the Bay Area and that sort of thing. In 1962, I met Beam, and I really liked him, and we got along fine. Now, he was much older than I am, of course. I think he was exactly twice my age when I met him, as I recall. And we corresponded for a while, and he actually told some fans that I was his best friend, which I didn't know. But you understand, I was an aerospace engineer at the Boeing Company in those years. I had nothing to do with science fiction. I hadn't ever written a story or a novel or anything. I just talked to Beam about history and politics and whatever guys talk about over a bottle of Jim Beam, really, usually. That was his favorite liquor for obvious reasons. And we had a lot of fun. And I didn't know that he was in desperate straits at the time. I didn't know nothing about that. I thought he was one of the great writers in science fiction. I'm kind of proud of the fact that when Analog did a survey on the most popular writers of all of their history, Mr. Heinlein was obviously first. But tied for fourth, but below Paul Anderson, was beat by me and Beam Piper of all strange people. So I would say I probably learned a lot. I learned to write from reading Beam Ford. I think he was a great storyteller, a much, much underrated. If that answers your question.
It does, thank you.
Thank you. Let's get the next one.
I actually was so shocked when he shot himself that I telephoned the chief of police in Bridgeport in Pennsylvania to ask if he was sure that it really was suicide. He said, "Yes, I'm sure. And if you'd seen the scene, you'd know it was." But I just couldn't believe it when Beam was killed. Beam was one of the guys who, I didn't know him that long, but Heinlein and Anderson were, the closest friend I've got is Larry, but once you get beyond them, Beam would rank right up there with them. So I was shocked.
Yes, sir. Good. So I wanted to find out what characters from your books, either together or individually, do you most identify with? Either you wrote that character from your own personality or would like to be like that character?
I've got a bunch of those. Bill Schaefer, Gil the Arm Hamilton, Kevin Renner from Moat. Are living characters. Resemble me.
Okay.
understand the question.
So which characters have you done that are the most like you, or that you like to be more like?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I don't think I'd like to be like John Christian Falkenberg, but I certainly developed him well, and a lot of people do like him.
And I learned to think like
my characters tend to be the strong, competent guys who get things done. Or screw up in the royalty trying to. Larry's tend to be people who get things done, but in a very odd way. I don't know. I mean, I draw characters from life, but I've had a lot of lives. I ran the Human Factors Lab at Boeing. I cooked more astronauts than any cannibal ever. I had to test the spacesuits at 400 degrees Fahrenheit with people in them. And if that ain't cooking an astronaut, I don't know what is. I've been deputy mayor of a big city. I've managed Barry Goldwater Jr.'s political and congressional campaign. I've met a lot of people in a lot of jobs and a lot of capacities. So in that sense, I've got more experience with that kind of people than Larry does.
I sometimes feel like Johnny One Note next to my collaborators.
But what a note, though. I mean, you know, come on, it's quite a note.
I only do one thing, and I do it well.
There we go. All right, let's get our next one. Thank you.
Dr. Cornell, in War World, Planet Haven, does mankind ever rediscover Planet Haven? You, I think, alluded to it in King James's spaceship, that they rediscovered a bunch of Serrani. But does mankind, have you written anything where they actually rediscover the Planet Haven?
Does mankind ever rediscover the Planet Haven?
Yes.
Does mankind ever rediscover the Planet Haven from
in War World?
I don't know. That empire, that Spaceship of the King, was my first science fiction novel. I'd written two detective story novels before that, but that was the first science fiction novel. And I sort of invented that old imperial structure, and I was going to do a lot more with it. But I had that empire, and when Larry came up with this alien, this asymmetric alien with two arms and one, we sat down and talked about it for a while, and by morning we had consumed several pots of coffee, at least one bottle of brandy, and a number of pads of paper, and we had what amounted to the structure of a story. And it used that empire. Having done that, and that being as successful it was, I've been a little reluctant to play around with that structure since. I invented War World, which I eventually gave to John Carr because he had worked for me as an editor for years, and I didn't have any way to pay him in retirement, so I gave him the world to play with, and he's done pretty well out of it ever since. But in general, I've been reluctant to fool around with that empire because I don't want it to impact on mode one way or the other.
Of course, we could still talk about it.
Yeah.
If you were willing.
We talk about it a lot. We even went to a Model United Planets conference where I was the representative and he was the mediator.
That's pretty good. Okay, another question?
Sure. So for the benefit of younger authors and aspiring writers, what are the most important writing lessons that you two have learned over the years?
I'd like to talk about collaboration because I've done a lot of it. There are some basic rules, and everything else is up for grabs. Everything I've tried has worked more or less. And every collaboration is different. But you need somebody to have the veto power, or else you'll hair off in two directions. You don't need, probably, you don't always need to get one of you to rewrite from scratch. Jerry tried that, did that with a wounded guy's eye, and rapidly found out that that we'd learned each other's styles. He didn't have to finish the job. You need mutual respect. You got to have that. Don't collaborate with an amateur. If you're an amateur, don't collaborate with a professional. You don't want to deal with a professional that stupid.
Let me point out that Larry deliberately took Steve Barnes under his wing, and that was sort of like collaborating with him. But Steve had written some very good stories, he just hadn't really learned the craft, and Larry developed him into the first class writer who he is. So now he's an equal partner with us in the Herod books. But when Larry and Steve started, Steve was an amateur. But in general, it is absolutely important that you have mutual respect. Because collaboration is each guy in it does about 90% of the work. Now that sounds crazy, but in actual fact, that's how you end up with a work that's about 180% better than it would have been if either one of you had written it. And that's the goal, is to write a much better book, not just to have a partner.
Yes. A couple of things to add. One is, I did a very easy thing with Stephen Barnes. I gave him a story I'd worked on and given up on and lost interest in. It costs me nothing to do this. It costs him nothing unless he sees an opportunity to write it. He could always say no. I've done that more than once. The other thing, I've forgotten, never mind.
You say it's something that you figured wasn't going anywhere otherwise, so you might as well let somebody else take a look at it.
Yeah. No? This time it worked.
Yes, sir.
In fact, he's got a public one that you can try. Sometime in the last 3 million years, someone carved a yin-yang symbol on the face of the moon.
Yeah.
We're going to make a story out of it, just give him credit for it.
I haven't got a story out of it in 30 years. I did it as an exercise when somebody suggested writing narrative hooks.
Huh. Okay, next question.
My father used to give me a hard time for dressing up at conventions until he read Draco's Tavern and realized, oh, this is a thing people do that's normal. So thank you for that, first off. But I was wondering for both of you, if anyone has ever dressed up as one of your characters, or have you seen someone running around a convention and been like, oh, I wrote that, and if it stood out for you.
Have you ever seen anybody dressed up as any of your characters at conventions or anything and jumped out at you?
Sure. Yes.
Yeah.
Sure. Particularly at a regional convention in Sydney, in Australia, where I was guest of honor. I saw a Pearson's puppeteer approach me on a wheeled platform at the airport. lived with him throughout the convention. He was at the reception desk.
And the plane he flew was transparent.
There were people dressed as costumes for my characters as a theme at the masquerade.
Yeah,
I remember. I gave the award to a guy who posed like this and was covered in frost from a short story called Waited Out.
Yeah.
Set on Pluto, where he's frozen.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, that
Anaheim Worldcon, they had a montage of characters from Larry Neville novels, and my son, my third son, who just retired as a Navy captain, played Beowulf Schaefer. He's 6'6" and slim as a toothpick, and he was then. And yes, yeah. As far as my characters, I see John Falkenberg all the time. I'm not. That's the main one I'm likely to encounter. I've seen Prince Lysander a couple of times, and but mainly Falkenberg is the guy that people show up as.
Thank you very much.
I think I've got time for maybe one more. You discussed the fact that you generally adhere to the no faster than light travel in your books, and in the forward to the book Limits, it discusses the idea that what limits you choose sort of guide and build your story. So I was wondering, how do you decide which limits you impose on your world and on yourselves when you're creating these stories?
Again, that's an art form. We learn how to do that. We learn how to decide which laws to give up. Giving up our law is like trying to eat one peanut. So you have to be careful with that. But in this field, you're generally allowed faster than light travel if you can talk. You can talk it plausibly. You can do it or you don't. But the hard science fiction has slower than light travel, no psychic powers, and still can get entirely wild.
Thank you. Well, I guess we have time for one more. I'm going to squeeze in one more. We'll be in.
In a lot of your works, you have the idea of some technology that's been left over from the past that future or that present day species can use, the slaver artifacts, or even the aliens in Footfall that have no real technology of their own. So, why is that a theme for you, and when are we going to find our technology that we can use?
I didn't feel that.
I didn't get the entire thing either. I'm sorry. Could you repeat it, and I'll make sure that Dr. Pan hears it.
Yeah, the idea that...
They go in here, and yeah. I have hearing aids, and I have trouble hearing.
I'll make sure you do.
Yeah, the idea that there's a lot of your plots have technology that's come from somewhere in the distant past that current-day species have the ability to use.
Technology that comes from the distant past, but that current humans have the ability to use, is that?
Yeah, like the Footfall made me think of it when you mentioned before, because the aliens who are invading, it's not their technology, it's from the race that used to enslave them.
Oh, yeah, the race in Footfall that enslaved them, they get the technology from them and use on
against them. Well, that was just a convenient way of getting the aliens up. You must understand, if we'd given the aliens much better technology, they'd have won.
Whatever you need is sometimes convenient for plot purposes to get someone else to build your miracles.
You need to be good at it.
The world wasn't built by Earth people. Right. I mean, I'd have had to describe the construction techniques, and I wasn't gonna.
Sometimes you just can't do something, but it would take too long. And I'm not going to go get a PhD in physics in order to write a story, although I do have a master's in experimental statistics. But
if you want to do hard science fiction and you want time travel for your human characters, somebody else has to build the time machine. The only way I know of to build a time machine and stick with present-day science is to build what looks less like a DeLorean than a highway. Looks more like a highway. And if you can find somebody else's highway, you can travel along it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There used to be conventions in science fiction. John Campbell had a rule that a science fiction novel or story could have one contrary to fact assumption. One of his favorites was Scythe, which basically was assumed that every you could do anything, but that's something else again. But an unnamed convention in those days was you got faster than light travel free. Because it, otherwise every space opera is a fantasy to begin with. And I had Dan Alderson develop me a faster than light travel system that was at least in theory possible, based on the discovery of a fifth force and tramways between stars and things of that sort. And I did that just to make it a little more feasible sounding, because I don't believe in it. I mean, I don't know. I would love to have Einstein wrong. And if you've ever read Peter Beckman's book, Einstein Plus Two, and if you haven't and you're interested in this, it's worth your reading if you can find a copy. It turns out that all of Einstein's assumptions that led him to the special theory of relativity, which is what limits us from ever having faster light travel or communications, can be explained in Newtonian terms if you assume that gravity has a finite speed of propagation. That all of these advances in the perihelion of Mercury, actually that was described in perfectly good Newtonian physics by a German high school teacher in 1878 or thereabouts. No indication that Einstein ever read that paper. It wasn't published in something like that. The point is, it's got done wrong by somebody else. And the bending of light by gravity does not require that gravity doesn't exist in red distortion of space. You can just say that light, after all, it's particles. Why wouldn't it be affected by gravity? So almost all of it, and the Michelson-Morley experiment can be explained. I mean, you'd have to read Beckman. That doesn't mean Beckman's right and Einstein's wrong, and obviously most, 99% of the physics world accepts both special and general relativity. And who am I to think that I can hope they're wrong? But that's... as an undiscovered technology in the human past, there is some, of course, with the anti-Cassara machine, which they have been painstakingly reconstructing, and it was an analog computer of enormous complexity and capability. We have evidence that in ancient Babylon they understood electroplating, of all things. They found what amounts to an electroplating factory. They can't understand it. How the hell? There's no other mention of it. So it was obviously a secret. So there are a few, but they're not... we don't know of anything that the ancients knew that we don't. Maybe it would be nice to find some.
Well, gentlemen, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank everybody for coming out. I want to thank these two guys for coming to DragonCon this year.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.